This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
I'm interviewing Dr. Sarah Crowther from the School of Earth, Atmospheric and Environmental Sciences here at the University of Manchester. Thank you very much for being on the Jodcast.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we really should have had you on before because you've been working virtually next door to where the Jodcast is all these years, but we haven't. So can you explain to us how your work, which of course sounds sort of maybe a bit geological, how that actually sort of ties into astronomy?
Yeah, so I work in the isotope geochemistry and cosmochemistry group, and a lot of our work is looking at extraterrestrial samples. So these can be meteorites or samples returned by various missions, and we're looking at the chemistry of the material to learn more about the history and formation and evolution of our solar system.
And do you think of it as astronomy?
Not exactly, no. My background was in chemistry, and the people in our group, we've got people with backgrounds in chemistry, physics and geology, and you need all those different subjects to do this. But we're more lab-based than a lot of astronomy work that's using telescopes and so on.
Okay, so you can actually get your hands on the experiment,
yes.
Which is nice.
Yes, I've just come from the lab.
Oh, brilliant. And how do you get your samples that you work on? Because obviously they're not necessarily here on Earth.
The meteorites are all here on Earth, and they tend to be held by things like NASA or museums. So the Natural History Museum in London have a big collection. And if we want to analyse them, we have to write a proposal saying what we want to do, how much material we'll need, whether we'll be able to send it back, whether we'll destroy it. So the scientific merit of what we want to do, really, and then they decide whether to let us have some or not. As I said a minute ago, some of the other samples are from missions. So we've had samples from the Apollo missions that went to the moon, NASA's Genesis mission, which collected the solar wind, NASA's Stardust mission, which collected material from a comet, the Japanese Hayabusa mission that collected material from an asteroid. So those are collected in space and brought back to Earth for analysis.
Wow, that's fantastic. I mean, even the Apollo missions, you sort of think of them as being quite a long time ago, over 40 years, but there's still analysis going on of the stuff they brought back.
Yes, there's still a lot of work going on, and there's other members of our group looking at those.
And with the ones that you just mentioned being brought back by spacecraft, which ones of those have you had the chance to work on, and what have you found out about those things?
I've done quite a lot of work on the Genesis samples. We've also done a bit of work on the Hayabusa samples, and we're working towards doing the Stardust samples.
So you have to remind me again which one was which. Now, Genesis said was the solar
Genesis,
wind,
Genesis, the you? Solar wind. So. Stardust was the comet and Hayabusa the asteroid.
And with Genesis, just to give all the listeners a bit of an idea, what is the actual material that's collected? What is the solar wind?
So it's the hot plasma that's coming off the sun. There's something like a million tonnes coming off a second, up to temperatures of tens of thousands of degrees. It's mostly hydrogen, because most of the sun's hydrogen, and I think 0.1% of it is all the other elements. And so in the mission, the spacecraft had these big collector arrays that were perhaps a metre-ish in diameter, and they were made up of hexagons of very, very pure silicon, sapphire and so on, and the ions of the plasma are implanted into those hexagons of silicon and so on, and then when we bring them back to Earth we can extract it again.
It sounds so tenuous, the actual plasma itself. I mean, you're sort of scooping it up, and then, I mean, I guess you can't just keep it in a jar.
It gets implanted into the material, right. So it's about between, I think, about 40 and 100 nanometers below the surface.
And then when you go about analysing it, how does that work?
So different people have used different methods, but the work I did, we basically hit the surface with a laser, a process called ablation. So we hit the surface with a laser, basically blast the surface material away for the first couple of hundred nanometers or so. So then we're releasing the implanted solar wind.
Gosh, that's brilliant. And then this is from someone who knows very little about chemistry. You're analysing really small amounts of this material. So
yes.
How do the instruments actually gain information about it?
So the instruments we use are all mass spectrometers. We have a whole range of different ones. A lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them are looking at noble gases, so helium, neon, argon, krypton and xenon.
It's not just the hydrogen?
No, we don't measure the hydrogen right. In our labs at all.
Okay.
But as I said, the hydrogen's about 99 point something percent, and it's probably about 0.1%, that's all the other elements. So there is very, very little material, and you need the most sensitive, the most high-tech instruments to be able to measure that. So the samples we were analysing had something of the order of perhaps 10,000 atoms of xenon, which was the element I was looking at in them. Now, if you compare that to a grain of sand or something that's got billions and billions of atoms in it, it's a really small amount.
And what results have come out of the analysis of the solar wind from Genesis?
Well, there's quite a lot of stuff, because they've been looking at all the elements. So, as I said, we just looked at one element, xenon. But people around the world have been looking at everything. People looking at oxygen, nitrogen, other noble gases. And the plan is to look at pretty much the whole periodic table. So for our work, the reason we were doing it was because the only previous measurements of xenon in the solar wind had been made from samples of lunar soils. And they can be complicated by other contributions. So, for example, you've got spontaneous fission of plutonium and uranium on the moon, which produce isotopes of xenon. You've got interactions of cosmic rays with barium and rare earth elements, which produce isotopes of xenon. And although the people who did that work had done everything they could to make the correct corrections and subtract those components, you couldn't be 100% sure that they got everything absolutely right until we measured directly sampled solar wind without those other complications. Now, it turned out they had got it pretty much spot on, and our measurements came out pretty much the same as theirs did.
And does it help to tell us about the composition of the sun in general, or more about what kind of elements are being kicked out in the solar wind?
A bit of each, I think. There's some parts of the sun that are believed to not really have changed since the solar system first formed, but there are other parts that have. So the solar wind is the closest we can get to measuring the sun. We can't go and get a sample of the sun and bring it back. It's too hot. Mm-hmm. And the data you get from spacecraft aren't accurate or precise enough, because we're talking about fractions of a percent difference between things, and the data you get from spacecraft isn't that good.
And that xenon presumably was present in the sun since it actually formed, since the solar system formed, I would guess.
That it wouldn't,
because I know elements produced by fusion, but presumably that would come later in the sun's life if it were to produce such heavy elements. And so I was just wondering, how related is the abundance of xenon in the sun compared to, say, on Earth? I wanted some xenon here.
That's a very interesting question. Because the isotopic composition of xenon in our atmosphere cannot be derived from the composition of the xenon in the sun. Okay. In theory, it should be able to. You should be able to derive it adding other components due to radioactive decay or so on, but your starting point should be the composition of the xenon in the sun. And you can't get from that to the composition of the xenon in our atmosphere. And this is a bit of a problem that people have been wondering about for a long time, and they hope that the Genesis data might shed some light on it. So perhaps show that there had been an error made in the data from the lunar samples. But it hasn't, so we still don't understand how the composition of the xenon in our atmosphere derived.
So do we have too much xenon? I mean, to be explained by...
We've got too much of some isotopes and too little of others.
Right. Well, that's interesting. So if I were to... I wanted to make a plasma ball and have some pretty colours using xenon, would I be able to extract that from the air? Is that how it's normally done here on Earth?
Oh, I don't know. I guess so. Yes, I assume so. I've not thought about that.
Well, going on to the other missions, now you talked about Stardust's next collecting dust from a comet.
Yes.
And is that something that you've also worked on, or people have here at Manchester?
Yes. In our lab, we're trying to combine the spectrometer in our lab with a technique that's used in a lab in Zurich called closed system step etching to allow us to extract the xenon. So the Stardust mission used a material called aerogel to collect the samples from the comet. And this is a very porous, it's a very weird material. If you have a look at pictures of it on the internet or something, it's sort of a bit blue, it's a bit ghosty, it appears very oddly, but it's very porous. So it's absorbed lots of air from our atmosphere. Usually when we're trying to extract the gas from our samples in our spectrometers, we heat them with a laser. Unfortunately, when we do this to the aerogel, as we increase the power of the laser, nothing happens, nothing happens, nothing happens, then it suddenly couples to the laser and all the gas comes out in one go. This would mean that we wouldn't be able to differentiate between the air from it just sitting around waiting for us to analyse it while it's been on Earth, and an echometry xenon, because it had all come out in one go, and there's so much air in there, and the echometry contribution would be so small, we wouldn't be able to differentiate. So this etching technique is a bit different. Instead of heating it with a laser, we attack it with hydrofluoric acid, a very low amount at low temperature, and it basically dissolves away from the outside in. So you dissolve the aerogel first, and then hopefully you can do that with very mild acid conditions, and if there's any echometry material in there, you'd need much harsher conditions to dissolve that and extract the gas from that. And we've done some tests with it using some non-flight aerogel, so some aerogel that's identical to that that was flown on the mission but didn't fly on the mission, and we can extract the air from it in that way. So the next step will be some more tests that way, then we'll put in some real samples hopefully.
So you're also interested in yourself, you're interested in the amount of xenon or the abundance of the xenon in the cometary material?
Yes.
I guess I imagined with a comet it's just sort of collecting a lot of dust, but I suppose that dust itself covers all sorts of materials. Is it also collecting essentially particles of gas as well?
Yes, it could have done. Gas could have got implanted. The dust's easiest to see because it makes tracks, like carrot-shaped tracks in the aerogel, but there could well be gas in there too.
And does the xenon tend to be trapped within something else, or is it sort of in the form of gas?
We haven't got that far yet with the stardust stuff, wow. There could be some gas, it could be in the particles.
There's a lot to find out. It's very interesting because we had another interview about Philae landing on a comet.
Oh, yes.
And it's always opening up a little bit of a box of surprises sort of from the early solar system.
Yes.
So it could, I suppose, be different in abundance to the Earth and the Sun, or it could be similar to one or the other.
Yes.
With the mission to the asteroid...
Hayabusa.
Did you say that was one that hasn't come back to Earth yet?
The first mission has, but the second one hasn't. The first Hayabusa came back a few years ago. The second one, Hayabusa 2, launched, I think, in about December, and is not due back for 10, 12 years or so.
So it's travelled a long way to get these samples.
Yeah.
How do you collect material from an asteroid? Because it doesn't strike me as something that's streaming off in the way it does from a comet.
No, this was a Japanese mission. I don't know the exact details of their collection mechanics, but it basically touched down briefly on the surface of the asteroid, scooped up some material, and then left again.
Right. Wow. Actually just scooped it up. Well, that sounds like easier than sort of collecting it with aerogel or what have you.
From an asteroid, yes.
And have you been able to analyse any of the samples from the first mission?
We had a couple of samples, yes. We're always the last people to get these things, though, because we destroy them. We heat them with a laser, melt them, and there's nothing left. And because there's so little material available, they want to get as much possible information out of every grain as they can. So they go to lots of other people doing lots of other techniques before coming to us. And then we zap them and destroy them.
Were you able to find xenon in the asteroid material?
Yes, we did. It was a very tiny grain, and so only a very tiny amount of gas, but we did measure some, yes.
Can that be relied on to sort of reflect the abundance, or is it that it's so low that you can't be sure if you were lucky to find a grain, or maybe unlucky not to find two? Or...
Well, yes, it was such a small particle. The abundance was roughly what we expected within a factor of 10. I can't remember the numbers. But it was such a small grain that it could be that the gas is distributed evenly everywhere, but it could be that some grains have a higher concentration than others. But we definitely saw some.
Mm-hmm. And is it also something of a relic of the early solar system in the way the comets are?
Yes. So and there's theories that the asteroids were material that should have formed a planet but didn't because it was disrupted by Jupiter's gravity. But a lot of the asteroids haven't changed much since they first formed. Some of them have, some of them have differentiated, got an iron core and a rocky outer layer like on Earth, but some of them haven't. Some of them really resemble the material that they first formed from. And it was one of those types of comets, sorry, asteroids that they went to that hasn't changed much, called a chondrite. So it does resemble the material that the solar system first formed from.
Brilliant. And when you analyse the meteorites that have landed on Earth, are you able to extract materials like xenon from them?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so they haven't been sort of completely kind of spoiled by their journey through the atmosphere and the high
temperatures? No. It's really only the outer few millimetres, if that gets hot as they come through the atmosphere. And you can, if you see the outside of one, it's got the fusion crust, the burnt outside on it. But that's, I'd say, a millimetre at the most thick, and the rest of the material underneath hasn't got hot.
And the abundances of xenon in those meteorites, does that depend where they originally came from?
Yes, it can do. The isotopic composition of xenon in many meteorites is similar. The abundances and other contributions from radioactive decay and so on can vary. So one of the isotopes of iodine-129, decays to produce xenon-129. Now, we can, there's only one stable isotope of iodine, that's 127. We can irradiate our samples in a neutron reactor before we analyse them, and that converts that iodine-127 into xenon-128, and then we can date them. It's a bit like carbon dating, but on different timescales and using different elements.
Okay.
So that's something we can do with the meteorites.
Because over a certain amount of time, a certain fraction decays.
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. And presumably, they could come out pretty old.
Yes. 4.5 billion years, give or take a few, usually.
Right. That's actually a very good sort of check that you are indeed probing the early solar system, isn't it?
Yes.
If you get the right sort of age.
Yes.
That's brilliant. Well, just the last thing then, I guess I must ask you, why is xenon your favourite?
Noble gases are particularly useful for the type of work we do for a number of reasons. Firstly, they're unreactive, so they're just sitting there in their elemental form. They've not formed compounds with other things. They're everywhere, but they're everywhere in very low concentrations. And they tend to have multiple isotopes which are affected by different processes. So, as I said, radioactive decay of some other elements can produce xenon and argon, and you can get reactions with cosmic rays producing some of the noble gases. And the fact that there's only a small amount of them means that these processes of radioactive decay or interactions with cosmic rays or whatever that might only produce a very small amount is a detectable change against a low background. So, you know, let's say we've got a process that's producing just a couple of thousand atoms against a background of a couple of thousand atoms. That's a massive fraction. But if you look at something like oxygen or nitrogen that are in much higher concentrations everywhere, a couple of thousand atoms is nothing against the background of 10 to the whatever atoms that are there to start with. Xenon has got 9 isotopes. It's got the most isotopes of all the noble gases. And there are lots of different processes, lots of different things we can learn from it.
And once they're there, they tend to stay as
you can sometimes, if there's been a, you know, an impact or another heating event to an asteroid or a meteorite, that can affect the amount, but it's not going to change the xenon into anything else.
Yeah. And maybe then as a very last one, what was it that originally motivated you to sort of take your scientific studies to materials outside the Earth, or originally from outside the Earth and elsewhere in the solar system?
I just think that it's really interesting. I've always had an interest in space. My background was in chemistry. I did chemistry at university, my PhD in physical chemistry, playing with lasers. And this lets me play with lasers and space rocks. So it's a lot of fun and it's very interesting.
Excellent. That's fantastic. Well, as you mentioned before, some of your colleagues have worked on lunar samples, and we shall definitely have to get some of them to come and give us an interview as well.
I'm sure they will.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.